So, you've probably been in this position to where you're meeting people, or maybe they're your long-term friends or something like this, and you run across the fact that they haven't seen this particular movie that you're like just jazzed about. You're like, this is a classic. You have to see this. I have some weird movies like that. All right. So take, for instance, there's this movie called Waking Ned Devine. Thank you. It's amazing. All right, Waking Ned Devine is this Irish film, all right? It's like low budget and all sorts of stuff. Irish film, it's about a guy who plays the lotto. The whole town plays the lotto. This guy plays the lotto, and he wins it. He wins it, and he dies in his bed from the shock of it. Like, he's there holding the ticket. And no, you know, and they find out, the whole town finds out that somebody in their little town out in the boonies of Ireland or something like this, you know, has won, and nobody knows who it is. Nobody's come forward. Who is it? Who's the person who won the ticket? And so it's all about them finding this guy, and, you know, he's dead. You know, like, what are we going to do? Because if he's dead, there's nobody to claim it. So they pretend to be him, and the whole town has to, like, commit to the whole lie to the lotto business and things like that. And it's absolutely hilarious and everything like that. One of the best scenes in that movie is actually the funeral scene where they pretend to put, you know, to rest this guy, right? So he actually is like talking about his own funeral effectively. It's really hilarious. And so anyways, if you have not seen Waking Ned Devine, you have my permission at this very moment to get out your phones and go onto Amazon and order it. And then talk to me about it next week. All right, so another movie, Muppets, all right? Muppets Christmas Carol. The best version, by the way. It's the best. All right. It's the best Muppets movie to begin with. It may be close to tied with Treasure Island, all right, but Christmas Carol is the best. All right. That scene in there where Kermit, who's playing Bob Cratchit, comes out and he's got all the little, you know, accounting bit of Scrooge thing. They're behind him and they're all the rats and they're all shivering and all this sort of stuff. And they're just like, oh, please, Mr. Scrooge, can we have a little bit more coal for the fire? And he goes, how would you like to be unemployed? And then they get a wardrobe change. They're all like, it is our island in the sun. This is a classic. It's best. And the puns in there are fantastic. And usually I'm a little surprised how it still remained. GE, you know, the puns are sometimes a little off, but they're adult. Hey, what do you know? And keeps us happy. All right, so that's the sort of thing. Speaking of Christmas Carol, though, in this film, in the book, I think it's got to be the perfect illustration of what David Brooks, that New York Times columnist I mentioned last week, what David Brooks talks about in the terms of the difference between what he says are the resume virtues and the eulogy virtues. All right, Christmas Carol, I think, is a perfect illustration of those differences. The resume virtues are what you put on your CV, all right? That's what, in the academic world, we call it your CV, your curriculum vitae. Everywhere else, it's called a resume. And I don't know why we do the different things, except that academics like to do things that are all snooty and stuff like that. So that's what we do. We have CVs. All right, and so it's what you put on your resume. Hence why they're called resume virtues. It's the stuff you say that makes you look more impressive than the person sitting next to you, right? That's what these things are. They're the things that help you move up in the world. I remember a colleague once told me, Jason, you should do this little event at UD. You should do it. It'll be boring. It'll take up a whole day. You won't learn much from it, but it'll be a good line on your CV. Right? These are the things that you do. They're the resume builders, right? They're the things that contribute, we would say, towards commercial success, gaining prestige. They're pretty much linked to everything that fuels the big me mentality that we talked about last week. They're not like bad in themselves or anything like this, but when they become all-consuming, then we have a problem. And so Scrooge was the king of the resume virtues. He had it all on that end, right? He didn't have any eulogy virtues, though, and that's the problem. See, the eulogy virtues are quite a bit different. They're everything Scrooge isn't. This is how Brooks describes them. I'll just read from him. He says, the eulogy virtues are deeper. They're the virtues that get talked about at your funeral, the ones that exist at the core of your being, whether you're kind, brave, honest, or faithful. They're all about the kinds of relationships that you formed when you were alive. These are the things that you want written on your tombstone. You want written on your tombstone. They're what you want remembered not just by your friends or your family, but by the people who never really liked you in life. You want them to at least be like, well, he did have this going for him, or something like that, right? These are the eulogy virtues. In A Christmas Carol, what freaks Scrooge out the most, if you remember the story, what finally gets him to change is when he gets visited by the ghost of Christmas Future, all right? The ghost of Christmas Future. The ghost takes him to a graveyard. It takes him to a graveyard, and he sees that the only people there to bury him is, you know, the gravedigger, right? This is the only person left. The only person there to bury Scrooge is the one who's actually digging the hole in the ground. It's not always mentioned in the movies, but if you read the book, all right, Scrooge asks the ghost to show him anyone, one person, who might even be the least emotional that Scrooge has died, and the ghost goes, okay, and shows them this couple who are rejoicing. They're super happy. And then he hears them say, now we have a lot more time to pay off our debt. So the one couple that's happy is the couple that's happy because he's died. Yeah. All right. And so Scrooge is depressed, of course. The knock against Dickens' story, the Christmas Carol, is that it's a bit heavy-handed, all right? It's a bit heavy-handed, but it gets the point across, doesn't it? We should be working just as hard building up our eulogy virtues as we should building up our resume ones. That's basically what Christmas Carol is getting at. Another way we might talk about the eulogy virtues is to talk about the term holiness. This is what it's getting at, holiness. Holiness is the heart of our passage from the book of Genesis today. For 2 weeks now, we've been talking about the story of Abraham and Sarah, right? The parents of the faith. In week one, we talked about how God called Abraham and Sarah out of this foreign land to the promised land and said, I'm going to bless you. I'm going to make this covenant with you to bless you, to make you a great nation, and then I'm going to bless everybody else around you. All right? He said if they would divest themselves or what they thought they knew about living and being in the world, and then he would instead take, if they would then instead take on God's way of living and being in the world, then he would bless them and everybody else. In week two, last week, we looked at the story of Abraham sacrificing Isaac, his son, up on the mountaintop. All right, we dug deeper into what God is calling each of us to divest ourselves of today, what he's calling each of us to divest ourselves of. And we spoke specifically about this big me mentality, that we're the center of our own worlds. We're Scrooge, right? That we think the secret to success can be reduced to something like following our hearts, all right? Being true to ourselves, making sure we work hard because nobody else is going to do the work for us. We put all of our emphasis right here, right on me, that type of stuff. This is what we call the gospel of self-trust. Self-trust. It's the opposite of what happened up on that mountaintop with Abraham and Isaac, where Abraham learned that we're not the center of our own universes, that the answers to this thing called life aren't found within us, but outside of us, that they're instead found in our attention to God and to each other. To end last week, we had these stones. We took them and placed them on this cairn, right? Here, in order to symbolize what God was calling each and every one of us to divest. That's how we ended last week. Today, our story is going to move around a little bit, our story about Abraham and Sarah, but we're going to start by talking about the time when God first explicitly told Abraham that he was going to make him and Sarah into this great nation. It's here that God explains that he's actually going to literally give them a son. So we're moving a little bit back in the story from when Isaac is actually born and about to be sacrificed. We're going back before he's even born, all right? Going back at the time of the promise being made. All right? It's actually the second time in the story of Abraham and Sarah that we see the language of covenant start to be told. The picture we get as we move further and further in the story of Abraham and Sarah, the picture we get is that God and Abraham and Sarah are progressively adding to the same covenant that they start in Genesis 12. If you remember Genesis 12, that's where God promises to lead Abraham and Sarah to the new land. That's the beginning. Here in chapter 15, we discover a few more important details about how that is supposed to happen. Here's what the text says. After this, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Do not be afraid, Abram, for I am your shield, your very great reward. But Abram said, Sovereign Lord, what can you give me since I remain childless, and the one who will inherit my estate is Eleazar of Damascus? You have given me no children, so a very servant in my household will be my heir instead. Then the word of the Lord came to Abraham, and he said, This man will not be your heir, but a son, who is your very own flesh and blood will be. And then he took Abraham outside and said, Look up at the sky, count the stars, if you actually can. And then he said, So will your descendants be. And Abram believed the Lord, and it was credited to him as righteousness. It's that last line that I want to hone in on this morning. And Abraham believed the Lord, and it was credited to him as righteousness. Another word for righteousness is holiness. Holiness. Abraham believed the Lord, and it was credited to him as holiness. Abraham believed God. He believed that God could and God would enable a 100-year-old guy and a 90-year-old woman to get pregnant. He believed it, and somehow this led him to be holy and righteous. And what I want to talk about is how that can be. What does that look like? It's a good thing that this was the thing that God counts as holiness and righteousness for Abraham, because if you read through the story of Abraham, beginning in Genesis 12, going on for about 10 chapters, if you read through it, Abraham had not been spending a whole bunch of time building up his eulogy virtues. In fact, in a culture that prided itself on the husband protecting the honor and the purity of his wife, Abraham was something of a lousy husband. We'd probably say he was a loser. All right? Almost immediately after God first makes that covenant with Abraham and Sarah in Genesis 12, Abraham goes down to Egypt to escape this famine in the land. He goes down there, and we find out that Sarah is awfully pretty. She's apparently beautiful, all right? She's beautiful, and Abraham is afraid that Pharaoh is going to see his wife Sarah, and Pharaoh's going to want her. And so Abraham turns to Sarah and goes, Sarah, tell everybody you're my sister, which was a half-truth. Back then, they did weird things. We're not going to dig into that. But she was also his wife, and he goes, tell everybody you're just my sister so that Pharaoh won't kill me to get to you. This is what he does. Tell Pharaoh you're my sister so that he'll let me live, which is what Sarah does. Sadly, Sarah gets very little agency in this story, but Pharaoh takes her to be his wife, all right? And then God sends all these plagues against Pharaoh. And Pharaoh wonders, what in the world is happening? What's going on? And he starts to figure it out. Something isn't right. So he looks down into it. He organizes everything. He realizes it must be Sarah. So he goes to Abraham and he's like, why didn't you tell me that she's actually your wife? Why didn't you do this? Why'd you lie to me? All right? And Abraham doesn't have any answer. So Pharaoh gives Sarah back to Abraham and asks them to leave, tells them to leave. If you're trying to tell a story, like the person who's writing Genesis is. You're trying to tell a story about the father of the faith. This is not really a good start, all right? The father of your faith was actually a guy who was pretty lousy, all right? The most righteous person here is not actually Abraham, it's Pharaoh. Pharaoh, all right? Pharaoh recognizes that it's probably not a good thing to take somebody else's wife. All Abraham does is act really scared and casually uses wife as a human shield. This is not holiness material. These are not eulogy virtues, all right? It doesn't get much better, actually. A few chapters later on in the story, Abraham does the exact same thing again. Again. In Genesis 20, Abraham and Sarah move to a place called Gerar, where there's a king named Abimelech, and lo and behold, Abraham is afraid that Abimelech is going to see how pretty Sarah is, so he tells Sarah to lie about who she is so that Abimelech won't kill Abraham. So she does. And the same thing happens over again. God plagues it and everything like this, and Abimelech is like, why did you lie to me? And Abraham's like, I thought you were going to hurt me because she's so pretty, which is sort of a weird sort of backhanded compliment. I don't know how this all works. So Abraham isn't just a failure is the point. He's a chronic failure, all right? He doesn't seem to learn. So what do we make of this guy? Holiness wasn't exactly his cup of tea. And yet God in chapter 15 still regards Abraham as holy and righteous. Holy and righteous. He says it's because he believed the Lord. It's his faith. It's because, it seems to be, from last week, if we remember, because Abraham kept pushing against the big me mentality, kept pushing against it by trusting that God could and would make good on his promise. You see, this is the real brilliance of the Abraham and Sarah story. It's true to life. It's true to life. Abraham isn't some unapproachable saint that we're supposed to mimic and can't, all right? He's a messed up dude. He's messed up. He's an abject failure of a husband. He cares more about his own skin than he does about his wife and those around him, the people around him, who always seem to suffer when he lies. And yet God still makes a covenant with this guy. And he goes on to credit righteousness to him. One of the earliest Christians, we're talking second century here. This is like the 100s, all right? One of the earliest Christians to talk about the holy life was a guy named Irenaeus, one of my favorite guys. All right, Irenaeus claimed that the Christian life is a process that continues all the way into eternity even. In other words, he said, we don't just become holy and righteous. We're always in the process of becoming holy and righteous, more and more holy and righteous. Holiness and righteousness, he says, they're not these static terms. They're dynamic. They're moving. They're flowing. They're more verbs than they are nouns. All right. Righteousness means to make right what is wrong in the world or in ourselves. And this continues on, Irenaeus says, all the way throughout eternity. All the way throughout eternity. If you're a math nerd, do we have this up here, this asymptote? All right, if you're a math nerd, it's like an asymptote. Irenaeus doesn't say asymptote, all right? But it's like an asymptote. Y'all know what an asymptote is? All right, some of you do. An asymptote, look at the curved line. See how it's getting closer and closer and closer and closer to the dotted line? Closer and closer and closer and closer and closer and closer, forever. Goes on infinitely. Always getting closer, never reaching. Irenaeus says that that's the life of holiness. That's the Christian life. For eternity, we're always getting closer and closer and closer to being like God, but we never reach it. We're always getting closer and closer to being holy and righteous, but we never get there. How could we ever become just like God? But like him, right? If you're more of a philosophical type, there's a paradox called Zeno's paradox. Does this strike any bells? It's a fun one. Zeno's paradox was this sort of thing. It was like, to get from here, the pulpit, to the lectern, everybody can agree that I have to go halfway at least, right? So if I go halfway, to get from the altar to the lectern, I have to go halfway. To get from here to the lectern, I have to go halfway, and I'm always going half and 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 half, and it never ends. You can cut everything infinitely so into halves, right? And so I never quite get there. That's the holiness life, Irenaeus is saying. We're always moving further and closer to being like God. It's this process. It's dynamic. It's all of that aspect. It's the same thing that we find out here in Genesis 15. What's going on with this righteousness that's being credited to Abraham? All right. He's not saying that Abraham all of a sudden entered into this sort of perfect state of holiness, the state of holy perfection. The text is saying that Abraham finally began to figure it out, to pursue righteousness. And he did this by believing, by having faith, that God could and would make good on the covenant, on the promise. Abraham took that first step towards holiness when he believed that God would enable Sarah to conceive. And yet the irony, the real sharp irony in all of this, in that first step, is that it's not really a step at all. It's a giving up, right? It's a giving up. It's the realization, just like we talked about last week, that we can't do this alone. That if we're going to get anywhere, then God is going to have to take the reins. That's what we call faith. That's what Abraham learned up there on that mountain when he was about to sacrifice Isaac. We are ultimately saved, he figures out, by the grace of God. But that doesn't end the process. It just fuels it. It fuels it. Abraham continues to struggle with cowardliness, with inwardness, with thinking he's got it figured out. That second time that he tells Sarah to lie about being his wife comes after this passage. After it's credited to him as righteousness. But when Abraham gets embarrassed, when he gets knocked down, he keeps coming back and he trusts God. He keeps coming back to trust God to do what it takes. Abraham realizes that he's weak, that he's afraid, that he's inadequate to the task, and God gives him the grace and the strength to resume the struggle. You see, what we learn here is that the holy life isn't this sort of static state. We don't possess holiness or righteousness. We pursue it. We pursue it. The eulogy virtues, Brooks writes, they're slow in coming. They're engraved during the struggle against our own weakness. Holiness and righteousness are built, come to find out, through what we call habit. Habit. Last week, we asked ourselves what God was calling us to divest, right? What he's calling us to divest ourselves of, and we symbolically grafted those things onto these stones, these rocks up here. We gave up what God was calling us to give up, and our prayer is that God will roll these stones away on Easter morning like he rolls away the stone in front of the grave, right? This is sort of our symbolic prayer. But here's the deal. We're going to be tempted to roll them back. That's how it is. We're going to be tempted to roll them back, to reinvest in the same big me things that we grafted into those stones. Holiness is the process by which we continue to lay them back down again. Continue to lay them back down again. Over and over and over and over again until we stop taking them back up. Until we're not tempted to even come up here and take them up at all. That's the holy life. It's not so much about winning the war within us. That's God's job. Holiness, the holy life, is about getting better at waging it. It's not about winning it. That's God's job. It's about getting better at waging it. In my newsletter article for this month, I talk about how I started to tell Emma and Marty these 12 words right before bedtime. And so I started to tell them, I love you, there's nothing that's ever going to change that. That's them. I love you, and there's nothing that's ever going to change that. I mentioned in that article that I became convicted that I wasn't loving my kids unconditionally, that it was kind of dependent upon, you know, whether or not Emma threw a fit, how well I would love her, or if Marty would not wake up in the middle of the night, I'd love him a lot better. These type of things, right? So I decided to start this habit of telling them that I love them and that there was nothing that was ever going to change that. It's not just for them, though. It's not just to help Emma and Marty know that their dad has unconditional love for them. It's as much for me. It's as much for me. I need to learn to love them unconditionally. I need to repeat these things over and over and over again. I love you, and there's nothing that's ever going to change that. What I'm doing is I'm building a habit, right? Building a habit that hopefully becomes something we might call character. Character. I'm actively trying to make right what is wrong in my life. That's righteousness. That's holiness. It's not the achievement of it, it's the struggle for it. All right? So my prayer is that with God's help, I'll become a more loving dad. I'll have built up a habit of true, unconditional love for my kids, and then my character will change. God will have given me a new eulogy virtue, we might say, and the stone that is my conditional love will be rolled away. You see, the first thing that we're called to reinvest in once we've divested ourselves of that big mean mentality is divestment itself. That's what we invest in, is a life of divestment, a life of holiness. That's the key. We're called to take up the struggle for righteousness, for holiness, to enter into a life characterized by the pursuit of it, the pursuit of holiness. So last week, when we brought our stones up here to this cairn of divestment, we began that pursuit. We began it. When we trusted God to be the God of our lives, and that we wouldn't be the God of our lives, we entered into the struggle for holiness. And like Abraham, last week, God credited it to us as righteousness. So you're on the struggle. You're on the path. Already, that began. All right? So as we begin our moment of reflection and meditation in a second, let's begin to ask ourselves how we're going to keep up the struggle. All right? What habits do you need to start building to help not take the stone back, to keep laying it down? All right? What are some practical ways that you can do that? Maybe it's repeating 12 words to your kids. All right? Maybe it's taking your rock from up here, putting it on your desk or your bedside lampstand at home so that it's a reminder, don't pick it up, don't pick it up, type stuff. Whatever it is, whatever it is, whatever it is. We're all on the path, all right? The promise in this passage, though, is super important. We're all on the path, but it's God who gives us the strength and the grace to continue it. Don't be afraid, Abraham, he says at the beginning. Don't be afraid. Just trust. And let's work. Amen.